Tell would like to announce that the Connecticut electors have cast 7 ballots for Joseph Biden Jr. for President of the United States.
In America, politicians don't take power. People grant power to them.
People ask me, is it hard to figure out if I should get tested for coronavirus?
I couldn't be more proud to represent the fact that I believe in science and I believe in our medicine. There's only one word that can really describe how I feel inside, and it is excitement.
This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Those were voices in the news this week, including a Connecticut member of Electoral College, Nick Belletto, announcing the result of the electors' procedural vote at the state capitol on Monday. We also heard President-elect Joe Biden. Also in the mix, self-described pitchman for COVID-19 testing, Jonathan Wharton, who's on our panel today. And finally, we heard from Wyndham Hospital Director of Medicine, Melissa Cumberland. She was among one of the people in the state to get a coronavirus shot in Hartford, also Monday. I want to welcome back to the show Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Associate Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. He's Interim Associate Graduate School Dean. Jonathan, we're glad you're here and we're glad that you're healthy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Lucy. I appreciate it.
We're going to be talking more about what Jonathan experienced with COVID in just a little bit. Also here with us, Christine Stewart, owner and editor-in-chief of Connecticut News Junkie and a reporter for NBC Connecticut. Hi, Christine.
Good morning.
Also here, Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show and a columnist at Hearst, Connecticut. Hi, Colin.
Good morning, Lucy, Jonathan, and Christine.
You can also join us on Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. So more than a dozen doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers got the first COVID-19 vaccinations in Connecticut. It was under a tent outside Hartford Hospital Monday morning. Health professionals around the state at different hospitals also receiving that vaccine. They were surrounded by reporters and photographers. The shots contained a vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. More Connecticut hospitals began vaccinating healthcare workers yesterday, and a second vaccine developed by Moderna and the National Institutes of Health could be given the green light in the coming days. Christine, I'll start with you. How significant is this milestone?
No, I think it's a significant milestone in that it also, gives us hope that we have the vaccine and that it is going to be distributed. It isn't going to be distributed to the general public or to anybody under the age of 16 for a very long time. But we need to get to herd immunity. And this is one way to do it. And it might take it's going to take a long time. I mean, we're going to be wearing our masks and social distancing for probably the next 2 years, but hope is on the horizon.
I like that you mentioned hope because we all need something to hold on to these days. Christine, were you one of the reporters covering the first vaccine shots in our state? Did you find it interesting to see who were the people that were first in line?
Yeah, I think that there is some healthcare workers who are actually nervous about this. This is the fastest a vaccine has ever been developed and approved for emergency use authorization. So I think that people really have to be reminded that, this is an emergency use authorization. And the only other time that a vaccine has been approved for emergency use has been the anthrax vaccine. And that was only distributed to the military. So it is a very, very unique circumstance. And so it is understandable that some people would be skeptical of a vaccine developed this quickly.
Mm. Colin, how do you feel about this moment in history?
I agree with everything that Christine just said. And I think what we get out of this right away is some assurance that our frontline workers are less likely to be overwhelmed by this problem. I think also the symbolism of it was great all over the country. There were repeats of what you described here in Connecticut. In some cases, there were crowds gathering to applaud the FedEx truck as it arrived. A lot of excitement there. And then as these things were unpacked, by the way they come in this complicated packaging with a kind of panel of lights on it, if you want the lights to be green, that means that the cold chain is held together. The vaccine can be trusted. If you see red lights, that's an indication you might not be able to use the vaccine. And just to build on what Christine said, yes, this is an EUA. There is currently no reason to fear these vaccines, but there's also just a lot of unknowns. I almost don't want to say this out loud, but, you know, it's possible that 9 months after vaccination, everybody has some kind of negative reaction. Cause we don't know because we're not 9 months out in the testing. I don't think that's going to happen. And certainly a lot of people who are smarter than I am about science don't think that's going to happen. But also, and I think we should proceed with the vaccinations, the benefits clearly outweigh the risks. But to build on another thing Christine said, and I think she was sort of hinting at it when she said, you know, it might be 2 years. Look, until the world is vaccinated, we're not really safe. I mean, this disease came to us from Europe and from China. You know, we are not going to get anything like 90% compliance on vaccines here in this country. We also don't know, to repeat what was said last week, how much immunity is conferred by the vaccine, how durable that immunity is, and whether the immunity includes the ability to repel the disease sufficiently so that, in other words, we know that the vaccine confers protective immunity. You don't get an expression of the disease if you're vaccinated. We don't know that it confers what's called sterilizing immunity, which means that you can't transmit the disease even though you haven't had it. And that is a genuine worry. We need to know way more about that than we know right now. So, yeah, we've got a long road ahead of us. Hope is exactly the right way to talk about it, and just having something to celebrate. Yesterday was a day of celebration. The celebration was completely valid and warranted, but there are enough question marks so that we shouldn't forget that there are risks ahead. The case rate is climbing. It's not going down right now. Our cases are going up substantially, and they will continue to go up for quite some time, vaccine or no.
Jonathan, how are you feeling? We've heard from people that describe this moment, what it must have felt like when man made it to the moon. Do you think that was an accurate comparison?
Well, I think so. And, you know, I would also add, I've been kind of obsessed about the timeline of everything, because it's interesting that we're going to see this in phases. We're seeing this obviously at the beginning of the holiday season here. And what does it mean in light of all the additional, you know, rates and how their spikes are taking place, not just in Connecticut, but in nearby states? Like, I mean, Newark is almost 40% in some neighborhoods. Rhode Island is a double digit. So we're kind of smashed in between here as a state, and, you know, having this all happen in the midst of the holiday season and is just, I don't know. I guess I find the whole thing disconcerting at the same time. Relieved that at least there's something taking place, but it's going to take phases for this to happen, right? This is not going to happen overnight. This is going to take over a series of months, and it's not just going to happen in weeks, unfortunately.
We saw over the pandemic in our country that masks became a partisan issue. This vaccination, is that also breaking down on partisan lines, Jonathan, where Republicans are more likely to see this as a personal choice, more likely to avoid getting the shot, and Democrats more likely to see this as something that we should all be doing collectively? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, the polls that have been coming out have indicated this. I also want to add, though, to listeners that I'm more weary of the fact that, you know, I would offer, we still have all these unaffiliated voters who might lean Republican. So they could proclaim in polls that they're Republican, but they're not. I wouldn't say that, you know, it's all Republicans or it's, you know, just a certain political party. I think, yeah, you're going to have a certain faction within one or the other going to be more obsessed about it than others. But whatever can take place to address these precautions should be a series of steps that should be bipartisan.
Colin, what do you think? What do you think in terms of how you're interpreting these polls and what public opinion is related to this vaccination?
I think, first of all, the vaccine acceptance is rising in the polls. And I think that's partly due to just sort of what we saw yesterday. The more people see it, the more that they see medical professionals avidly seeking the vaccine, that will tend to increase confidence. I think vaccine skepticism comes from essentially three sources. One of them is the group of people who have been skeptical about vaccines from, you know, from the jump. And that, you know, I mean, before COVID, people who are skeptical of measles vaccines, for example. And now that thing that tends to know no politics. It doesn't necessarily track right. We don't know that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., for example, is, you know, one of the leading arguers on behalf of that point of view. I think there are some Republicans who regard this as state interference. Don't tell me what to do. I mean, that's obviously also kind of a libertarian argument. And I think there are some people on the left who don't trust Donald Trump. And they heard this be called Operation Warp Speed, which sounds like something that was done in a big hurry by a guy who also was very concerned about getting enough credit and having the FDA approve it faster and not wanting England to go first. And that all strikes them as self-seeking by a guy they don't trust very much anyway. So I think the politics of this are muddled and muddy. It's unfortunate that there are any politics to this at all.
Christine, I wanted to go back. Go ahead, Christine.
I was just going to add that the University of Connecticut is doing this really interesting study on what messages they need to use in order to encourage people to take the vaccine. And by playing on emotion, you would think that maybe, you know, fear would be the emotion that you would play on, but it's actually the emotion of disgust. So the more disgusted you are, the more likely you are to be taking these steps to, you know, make sure to sanitize your hands, make sure to wear a mask, make sure to actually take the vaccine when it becomes available.
You said something earlier about some healthcare workers having some concerns about this vaccine. Does that include nursing home workers? What are you hearing about their concerns?
Yeah, I think that nursing home workers, nurses in general, there is some concern. And I think we heard Dr. Reginald Eady, who is the head of the vaccine subcommittee and the president over at Trinity Health of New England, that say that about, he estimates based on his survey of 13,000 employees, that about 60% are going to voluntarily take this vaccine. No, there's no indication that anybody's going to mandate this vaccine be given to healthcare workers, but there are concerns among healthcare workers, and I think just the general public. I mean, I think that there's some skepticism because we don't know. We don't have 9 months of research available to know exactly what any sort of long-term side effects would be.
But now most of us know someone who has either gotten COVID or unfortunately has passed from COVID. Jonathan Wharton, I mentioned earlier in the show that you were sick and you had COVID-19. So can you talk about this with us? And, you know, sure. How bad was it? And a little bit more about your experience with just testing and contact tracing.
Certainly, Lucy. Well, as you know, I helped out with a public service announcement back in the summer about it. And interestingly enough, it was about testing. And my biggest concerns was surrounding the testing. Unfortunately, at my university, it was only done for students living on campus and coaches, but not for administrators and faculty. So I had to do the online thing of going through the local CVS, which took days to get an appointment, and then took days to get the results. So unfortunately, I didn't really know for nearly a week. I put all my classes online. Thankfully, we did the contact tracing. I was tipped early enough within a couple of days, so I'm fortunate in many regards. My symptoms were all over the map, and it really was kind of fascinating to me how it took days, because it wasn't until the day after I got notified that it kicked in. And it was oversleeping. I was very listless, weak. I had just headaches for days. It almost lasted a week, in fact. That surprised me most, with the headaches. My temperature went up really for about a day, and then it subsided. I did have a bit of a cough towards the end of it, but then for me to get it out of the system was probably the bigger nightmare, because I was getting tested almost every, maybe let's say 8 to 10 days. It took a couple weeks for me to get it out of my system. So that was probably a big issue on top of everything else. But fortunately, it wasn't as severe where it required the hospitalization. I have asthma, so I was really obsessed about my respiratory concerns. I didn't have that, thankfully, so it could have been a lot worse, obviously.
Does it change how you move around, Jonathan, in terms of who you're around these days? Do you feel more anxiety or less?
I do. And I have to say that my neighbors, thankfully, were there for me. I live alone. They noticed that something was wrong because I didn't take the trash out. My car wasn't moved. I mean, they were texting and they were on top of me concerned. And so they caught everything, thankfully. and they helped me out, especially with Thanksgiving meals. God bless them, because I was eating it alone. It's my favorite holiday. So, and it's kind of unfortunate because I've been very close to my neighbors, but they have been there for me and I've been very grateful for it. So that's something I certainly don't want to take for granted again. It's amazing the little things you do take for granted, and that's one of them I won't overlook. As a matter of fact, I've already given them Christmas gifts already this past week, just bottles of wine. That's how grateful I am.
Hmm. Well, we're glad you're doing better. When you think about the people you know, have they changed their feelings on this virus, given your personal experience?
You know, you would think so. It's interesting. Those in the healthcare field who I know have been asking me all the same questions, you've been asking me even more. And then some of my friends who are very partisan about this, you know, they'll take it extreme saying, well, you know, this is what you get for being a Republican. I was really kind of taken back by that, especially on Facebook, to the point where I'm just blocking the posts now. And then I've got the others on the other side of it who say, well, it was just a flu. So to get caught in the middle, it's kind of disheartening. And these are my own friends and colleagues I work with on both sides of the fence. And so I don't like being caught in this, and it's jarred me. Because these are some of the closest people I work with and that I know.
Mm. Earlier, Colin, you mentioned how cases are rising, hospitalizations have increased. When we hear from people like Jonathan, who had to wait at least a week to get test results, you know, how worried are you when we think about, you know, trying to bend this curve?
Worried. And Christine said an important thing at the beginning of all this, which is, you know, you should think about the vaccine right now as another thing that you have in addition to masks and hand washing and social distancing. Now you also have vaccines. Some of the people around you will gradually be getting vaccinated. You shouldn't think of vaccines as an alternative to all those things. I think we're going to have difficulty bending the curve. The disease has, you know, been fully nationalized now. You know, Jonathan was talking about Rhode Island, and we should be worried about the high rate in Rhode Island, but we have to be worried about the high rate everywhere. This disease moves around a lot. I think right now the biggest danger, well, I mean, obviously we have over 300,000 people dead. That's a huge danger. But I mean, I think a huge source of concern, particularly in other places, is the overwhelming of the healthcare system. The vaccine's good news, as I said before, in that way. If fewer of them are likely to get sick while trying to treat patients, that's really good news. But you can't vaccinate the healthcare workers against having too many patients to treat. And that's the other part of that overwhelming process. Yeah, I think people should be very worried. I think December, January, February, these are going to be very, very troubling months.
I wanted to move on. We were talking about vaccines, and the Connecticut Mirror reported lawmakers in the General Assembly are planning to push for an end to the religious exemption for vaccine requirements when the session begins January 6th. Lawmakers supporting the effort say a bill would not include a requirement for a COVID-19 shot, but anti-vaccine activists say they don't see what would stop lawmakers from requiring a COVID shot. Christina, I wanted to talk with you because I know you've covered this when it came up in last session. Talk about what lawmakers are up against this time around. Will skepticism over the COVID-19 vaccine affect this debate again?
Well, I mean, I think that there's skepticism over the COVID-19 vaccine, but let's be very clear. The emergency use authorization was only for people above the age of 16. And so we don't think that, I mean, the earliest that this might be available for like 12 to 16 years old might be, the earliest would be April. So we're not talking about, like, right now, the legislation is to eliminate the religious exemption for childhood vaccinations. So the COVID-19 vaccine is nowhere in that conversation because there's no ability at this point, because the FDA has not approved it for that type of use in children, that would be part of the discussion. So, but obviously it's going to get confused and cloud the discussion. But I think that how incoming House Speaker Matt Ritter made some very strategic moves, in which he moved off to lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, who voted against the legislation motion in the Public Health Committee last time it was up for debate. So, and that was a 23-hour hearing. So people have very strong feelings about this issue, but it is childhood vaccinations. And also another side effect of COVID-19 and this pandemic in general has been that we have not been allowed, children have not been brought to their pediatricians to get vaccinated against some of these childhood vaccines. The number of doses that are given out has been much lower than it has been in previous years. So there are some deadly childhood diseases out there, and we've had these vaccines around 4 years. So it is going to be something that's going to be up for debate, and it's probably going to be hotly debated, and it's going to be interesting because the building will not be open to the public. So there will be no large public hearing where people can gather, but it will be done via Zoom.
Colin, before we head to break, you know, what are your thoughts on this coming up again, this session, and given what Christine pointed out in terms of childhood vaccines, the COVID-19 one not being online for children probably until late spring?
Yeah, and there's a lot of ways that you could write this law also. I mean, the COVID-19 vaccine, as we keep saying, is authorized under an EUA. You could write the law so that it only applied to vaccines that have run the entire testing course and are fully approved by the FDA. The problem is that the argument against it is one of these arguments that I can never quite understand. It's the, what is to stop them from doing this? Well, they're not proposing to do this. It's like if you had a law banning cockfighting, and they said, well, what is to stop them from preventing ownership of chickens? Well, nothing really. I mean, there's no Second Amendment for owning chickens, but they're not talking about doing that. They're just talking about banning cockfighting. Similarly, they're not talking about rescinding the religious exemption in a way that includes the COVID-19 vaccine. So the only way it will happen will be if they go back on their word, or if there's a completely different bill drafted, and that could happen anyway. So, I mean, there's no way that you can answer an argument like this.
I wanted to just bring Jonathan back into this. I just remembered, House Minority Leader, he's again a Republican, Vincent Candelora, brought up the point, you know, why should this bill to vote out or erase religious exemptions, why should that be a priority this session when you think about all of the other challenges facing lawmakers in this pandemic? What are your thoughts quickly, Jonathan?
Well, I don't think we should be surprised in light of this past spring, right? Because there were concerns about vaccinations, other vaccinations for children, and the religious exemption. So we shouldn't be so surprised that that's back on the table. That was a big issue at the beginning of the year, and it's one that was never fully addressed in reality.
Can I just quickly say the one reason to be concerned about it right now is what we've been talking about before. You want to keep other kinds of conventional diseases as repressed as you possibly can in an environment when healthcare facilities are being overwhelmed by deluges of COVID patients. That would be the reason to step up your commitment to vaccines. You don't want people getting sick from other things.
That's Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show and a columnist at Hearst, Connecticut, here on The Wheelhouse with Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Associate Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. And Christine Stewart's here, owner and editor-in-chief of Connecticut News Junkie and reporter for NBC Connecticut. Coming up, the Electoral College puts its stamp of approval on President-elect Joe Biden's election win. Now, will Republicans accept it? We'll talk about that after the break. This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, broadcasting remotely. On the panel today, Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Associate Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. He's also Interim Associate Graduate School Dean. You can follow him on Twitter at PreppyProf. Christine Stewart's here, owner and editor-in-chief of Connecticut News Junkie, a reporter for NBC Connecticut at CT News Junkie on Twitter. And Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show and a columnist at Hearst, Connecticut at Colin McEnroe. You can join us too on Twitter at WMPR Wheelhouse. Now, Connecticut's Electoral College members gathered in the Senate chamber at the state capitol Monday to cast the state's 7 electoral votes for Joe Biden. No surprises there, Christine, but can you describe the process? How different was it from years past, besides masking and social distancing?
Well, the masking and social distancing. So that was a little bit different. But the ceremony itself is a very interesting ceremony in that each of the electors cast their votes and they go into this little wooden box that is made specifically for this purpose out of part of the Charter Oak Tree. And then they announce the votes and then they are sealed. The votes are sealed with some sealing wax melted with a candle and they are sent to the Vice President of the United States and to other various parties and it becomes official. And this happens at state capitals across the country. And Connecticut's electors are not allowed to be faithless electors. So they do have to, they get chosen at their party conventions and they do have to say, you know, I will be faithful and I will cast my vote for the winner of Connecticut's popular vote.
Who are the electors, Christine?
Yeah, so the electors can't be elected officials. The electors are just people who volunteer who are really interested in politics and who have participated in the democratic process, but are just, you know, they're just regular people, I guess. They volunteer. There were 36 applications and seven of them were chosen at the Democratic Party convention.
Zooming back out nationally, Colin, we know the president still claims the election was rigged, the votes are fraudulent. Now the Electoral College has decided. And so what do you think is going to happen in the next few weeks? And does it shut the door on any other ways that President Trump can question the outcome?
Let me just back up and say that yesterday was different in some of the other states in ways that did not involve masks and social distancing. In Michigan and I believe Arizona, they had to take a special security precautions because there were credible threats of violence against the electors. In the case of Michigan, not only did they shut down the state capitol where the vote was to take place, but they wound up having to shut down other government offices or other legislative offices as well. That's the world that we're living in right now. I would say, first of all, you know, you have to sort of divide this whole process into several phases. Starting on November 7th, November 7th was the day that the AP, Fox News, and everybody else certified the Pennsylvania results. Biden had clearly won. There was cheering all over the land. Congratulations started to come in from foreign leaders. It was very clear that Joe Biden was the president-elect. After that, President Trump spent weeks and weeks. It's six weeks later. You know, he spent weeks and weeks trying to undermine, discredit, and create an atmosphere of doubt about a free and fair election. That didn't work. It especially didn't work in the court. I think they've lost close to 60 court appearances at this point now. And so then they entered the third phase, which is to try to nullify or overthrow the actual vote. That's what's been happening in recent days. On Friday, the Supreme Court refused to hear a case that was essentially about nullification of the electoral vote, about the overthrowing of the votes of the American people. They were essentially asking the Supreme Court to do that and choose a different winner in this election. I would say that, to my dismay, 17 Republican attorneys general joined in this suit, which had no basis whatsoever. There were no credible allegations of fraud or defect in the count. They just wanted somebody else different to win. I believe 124 Republican members of Congress also publicly supported that vote, including Kevin McCarthy, who is the Republican leader of the House. In Congress, they supported that case, which had no merit, was simply a case, an attempt to use the court, if possible, to muscle out a different result. So we have been through and are still in a terrifying assault on democracy. If you think that the bedrock notion of democracy is that the person who wins the election ascends to the office, that has been called into question and is still being called into question. Over the weekend, President Trump, in interviews, talked about Biden being an illegitimate president who lost badly in the election. I don't even know what to call that at this point.
So it goes without saying that you're not impressed with Mitch McConnell finally acknowledging Joe Biden's win. What's really going on there, Colin?
I think, first of all, it's better than nothing. And I might add that Kevin McCarthy, his counterpart in the House, has not done that. I think McConnell is just, you know, I don't think he sees any upside in this thing, this course continuing. Trump is unhappy with him for doing this. I don't think it can be construed as an act of political courage at this point. As I say, we're about 42 days out from the election. So, but I think, you know, McConnell, if he believes at all in any institutions, has to say this at this point.
Jonathan, what's your take? What is this? What is this doing to the Republican Party, and how do GOP voters think about this?
Well, look, beyond even Mitch McConnell, I mean, even locally here, J.O. Romano acknowledged just recently about what took place here and said that, you know, this is the process and it's time to move on. And I think there are a number of Republican leaders who are certainly in the Senate who feel the same way. There is all this concern and talk that they'd wait until the Electoral College officializes everything. Now there's all this talk to wait until January 4th when Congress, you know, certifies and verifies everything. But look, this has been a process. It has been an unusual one. I've been amazed at how many Americans have been obsessed at following all of this, because there was little concern about the Electoral College prior to all of this. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's concerned about who these electors are, which is kind of fascinating to me, because many Americans weren't even that aware of the Electoral College, let alone, as Christine offered, these were party leaders and officials who served as this function. And so I think I see more of an upside on the other side of this, that you're going to see more people following the process of everything now when it comes to Electoral College, why and how the decisions are made. What can we do to reform it? You know, I'm really concerned in the future as to whether something could take place similar to Nebraska and Maine, where states could take on proportional voting as opposed to winner take all among states. So I see this as a time for some overdue reforms and some genuine interest among people in recognizing that, hey, this is mostly an inside process dynamic among the political parties.
But do you worry that there are going to be Republicans that see this as an affront to democracy, that they're going to leave the party for what has happened since the election?
Look, I think that some of that's going to be inevitable anytime you're going to see some of this being politicized, whether it's by Trump or by his supporters. So that's going to be expected. Now, what will this mean for the Biden presidency, Lucy, is going to be interesting after January, because this is certainly an issue that I don't see going away.
Colin, what do you think about what Jonathan has shared?
Well, I do think that here in Connecticut, the Republican affirmation of the election results, at least from what I can tell, and maybe I've missed a few things here, but short of Mark Boughton, who we're going to be talking about in the next segment, there really hasn't been very, at least I've missed the situations in which Republicans have stepped forward and said what Boughton said, which I think he said on November 19th, which is that this is essentially over, Trump should step aside, he's hurting the democracy by what he's doing. That was a very necessary thing. You know, if you believe in democracy, what did Chris Murphy say the other day in his speech? You can't hate democracy and love America. I feel as though the response nationally has been horrendous in the ways that I just described. Mm-hmm. Here in Connecticut, it's been a little bit more tepid and anodyne and passive. I would have liked to have seen, and I think in the past, I would have seen more Republican leaders stepping forward to say, this has gone on too long, this has gone too far. And you know, the point at which it's gone on too long and too far is somewhere, you know, shortly after November 7th. It isn't, December 14th isn't when you decide it's gone too far.
So, Jonathan, let's talk more about the Republican Party here in our state. So the GOP holds no statewide elected offices. It controls no seats in the congressional delegations. Its minorities shrank in both houses of the General Assembly. J.R. Romano's leaving in the spring. What do you want to see happen with the party?
Well, of course, as my op-ed in Connecticut News Junkie offered last month, this is really the opportune time to see some changes, some reforms. It's been no secret that for years, a number of party leaders and voters have wanted to seek change at the state and local level, this is the moment between certainly next month and I would argue into the summer, because as you mentioned, the party chair's race, but also say Central Committee for the Republican Party as well, because they have to be decided in May. And we can't forget, Lucy, you know, gubernatorial election, we're on the eve of it come next year. So that's going to be key for the state party and getting the brand out there, because my biggest fear, as I often in the column, is that we're going to have entirely too many candidates again running for governor, let alone lieutenant governor. Last time we had more than two dozen, just on the Republican side alone. So, you know, it'd be interesting if there's a way to, kind of streamline the process for the Republican Party, to make some overdue reforms to it internally, whether to find pathways of opening up and getting more voters to register with the political party, because we're just teetering at 20%. What reforms can take place at the state and even the local level with all these town committees and the state central committee? This is really a good time to seek some overdue reforms for the political party.
Last cue on voters, Jonathan, the Republican voters who think this election was stolen, will they show up next election?
It'll be interesting because will this have an effect on the gubernatorial race and even the local races, Lucy? As you know, next November will be a lot of local races. So will that transcend into an uptick of participation for people to participate in the state and local races? In the past, I would likely say no, because what takes place nationally doesn't quite transcend to what takes place in terms of state and local races. So I'd probably err more on the historical side of things for that.
That's Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Associate Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University, here on The Wheelhouse with Christine Stewart, owner and editor-in-chief of Connecticut News Junkie and a reporter for NBC Connecticut, and Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show and a columnist at Hearst. Speaking of Republicans, a well-known Republican is moving on to a new job within the Lamont administration. We talk about the person making the move. Here's a hint. He has gone by the nickname Big Papa online. That's coming up after the break. This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Danbury Mayor Mark Boughton is leaving his city job to become state tax commissioner. In a video on social media, he said he's still Republican, but Boughton is crossing party lines to join the Democratic Lamont administration. Christine Stewart, you've covered politics for a while here in our state. Did this surprise you?
No, I mean, it didn't necessarily surprise me. I think that it's an interesting decision by the Lamont administration, and I'm not quite sure necessarily what it says for his tax strategy in the state of Connecticut. We always knew that Governor Lamont was more or less from, he's from Greenwich, and he is a millionaire. And so as far as raising income taxes on people, he has been very opposed to that and thinks that Connecticut's tax structure is sufficient the way it is. And, you know, by hiring a Republican into this position, which the legislature still has to approve Mark Boughton's nomination, maybe he is signaling that he is more aligned with his Republican colleagues when it comes to tax policy.
Jonathan Wharton, what was your reaction when you heard?
Okay, so I'm sorry, Christine. I know you're going to laugh at me on this. I was floored. I did not expect this, and certainly not right now. I was hopeful he was going to run again for governor. I think some people were thinking the same. But of course, he's run multiple times. And so there must be some kind of frustration, certainly within.
Well, I think that, I just want to say that, he would have won. I mean, he won the party convention if the Republicans had decided to go along with this, process and not run outside of the, outside of the lane of the traditional convention process.
Not to mention, Christine and Lucy and Colin, I think you all know that whole convention process is so bizarre because he narrowly won that endorsement. It was like just a little over 50%. And I was one of the delegates at that last convention for the governor's race. And it was just so quirky how it took so long to get him that endorsement because of all these candidates running. So maybe he just finally had enough of it. I guess you can't blame him, but I was just surprised that he I don't want to say defect, but I don't know. It's a big jump.
And he is one of the most prominent Republicans in the state, Jonathan. Should the party be concerned, as we just talked about the future of the party?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. Lucy, I think no surprise, you know me. I mean, you know, he follows me, I follow him. We go back and forth on Twitter. As a matter of fact, I was direct messaging a few mayors, no surprise among Republicans about this. And I think their concern is, what does this mean for our brand and where are things going now? And who knows? It goes back to my earlier point of what will next year hold for the state party now. And to add to everything with the mayor going to the governor's administration.
Colin, what do you think about this move for Mayor Bowden?
Well, I think several things. First of all, Mark's a great guy. And I actually, in 2014, he was sort of the Republican analyst opposite me on election night here on NPR because he wasn't allowed at the Foley headquarters that time. I think that Mark knows that his political career is essentially coming to an end. And that the Republicans, again and again in these gubernatorial races, have preferred wealthy people like Tom Foley and Bob Stefanowski to people like Rob Simmons and Mark Bowden, who have lifetimes of public service. I mean, that's sort of the way that it goes down over and over again. I think Mark sees the handwriting on that wall and also knows he just can't win a primary if you don't have those kinds of resources to spend on it, not the way the Republican field has shaken out time and again. He's also had significant health problems. He really is a very, very nice person, and he's good company, and I think some of this probably has to do a little bit with having a better pension and of course having great state health benefits and stuff like that. And I wish him all of those things. He's been through a lot in terms of medically speaking. But I do think it is a problem, as Jonathan says, for the brand, because Bowden is the guy who went on the Ethan and Lou show or whatever the hell it's called and said, you know, that Trump shouldn't undermine the democratic process. He really shouldn't. Look, I'm on the same team, so he should not undermine the process. It's not good for democracy. Probably having taken that position, he also knew that he might not win a primary the next time around. And oddly enough, you know, Ned Lamont has kind of co-opted the most reasonable, prominent Republican in the state of Connecticut and probably taken him out of the play. But that was also Mark's choice. I think it's a good choice. Last thing I would say is, I don't think the Commissioner of Revenue Services really sets a lot of tax policy. I mean, they administer the tax collecting policy, the tax collecting process. The policy comes from somewhere else.
Christine, what do you think about this affecting the Republican brand in the state?
No, because I think that in order to be mayor of a town, you really, you know, there's no Democratic way or Republican way to pick up the trash, right? So, you know, when he was actually doing the governance for the city of Danbury, you know, there were probably very few politics involved. But, you know, it is smart, I guess, of Governor Lamont, and maybe this means that he is going to be running for re-election, that he take out one of the most prominent Republicans who could possibly run against him.
And what a career when you think about Mayor Bowden, 10 terms as mayor, just reelected in 2019, Jonathan mentioning he's run for governor, I think, three times. Christine, what's been the response from progressives in the Democratic Party with this move by Lamont?
There is concern among the progressives in the Democratic Party about why the governor made this decision, why he announced it when he did. You know, so I don't think it's going to be they are probably going to confirm him. I would guess that they're going to confirm him, but I would guess that there was also going to be some votes against him, especially from the progressive wing of the party.
I just want to say it's a good decision, and it's a decision based on civility and extending an olive branch to the other side to a certain degree. And it's not a decision, as I said before, that's going to have a big impact on policy. Policy is going to be set by the legislature and by Lamont, not by Mark Bowden. I don't think anybody should have a real problem with this. It's a good sign when you do something like this.
And Christine, can I ask, who is Joe Cavo who's going to take over?
He was the town council president. So under the charter in the city of Danbury, the town council president takes over when the mayor leaves.
Christine, are you not intimately familiar with Danbury civic politics so that you can give us an extensive description of Joe Cavo?
I am
good
not.
Luck, Joe.
I have no idea who he is. Yeah.
Wow, good luck, Joe. You confessed that to that, Christine. That's impressive.
No idea.
Well, I want to move on to feats of strength, airing of grievances. Jonathan, go ahead.
Wow. Okay, so I'm first. Boy, well, I think you know, I'm just trying to get through finals grading this week, and I'm just struggling so hard. As somebody who teaches state and local politics, how even after I teach a class like I did, how so few students still don't get that we are the state constitution state here. You know, we're the first ones that did it, and yet for so many of my students, they think the federal government is it, and that we were mimicking the federal government when it was the complete opposite. So I don't know what's going on in civics these days, but it's really disturbing me. So I could not quite sleep last night. And it's just a tough time for me to kind of comprehend. So forgive me all, especially as a nutmegger.
Colin?
I'm going to say a feat of strength for Mackenzie Scott, who is the 18th richest person in the world and is giving away her fortune at a record clip. She donated $4 billion to charity in 4 months. One of those charities was not Skype, I don't think. And she's going to give away $6 billion this year. More rich people should do this. Quick other interesting thing, also possible feat of strength for a guy named Nick King. I think he's a Stanford guy, although he may live in Darien. He is trying to start a black-owned cereal company and has gotten so far as a name and a crowdfunding process. I'm going to watch that. That could be like a really interesting thing. The cereal, I believe, is called Power Puffs. So keep an eye on Power Puffs. I mean, there's sort of a gleam in his eye right now, but I kind of like this idea.
Nice. Proud
Puff. Proud Puff.
Proud Puff. Okay. I'm writing that down. Christine Stewart.
So I guess it's a feat of strength, but if anybody is looking for a last minute Christmas gift, and this is probably bad because it's probably very difficult to find at this point, but there's a book called The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse, and it's a children's picture book, but it is very much also for adults, and it is about kindness and adventure, and it's told through these lovely pictures, and that's it.
I just want to send out a grievance to school districts around our state, even Governor Lamont, for suggesting tomorrow, the first big snow, that kids should still be doing remote school. Come on, how am I going to get my kids to log on tomorrow with all that snow out there? I want to thank our panelist, Christine Stewart, again, who is the owner and editor of the Connecticut News Junkie and reporter for NBC Connecticut. Thanks for coming on, as well as Dr. Jonathan Wharton, associate professor of political science and urban affairs at Southern Connecticut State University, and Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Today's show produced by Matt Dwyer. Our tech producer is Kat Pastor. Thanks so much, and join us again next week.